Good morning, Chief Justice Moon and honorable members of the court. My name is Thomas Yeh, representing the Hullabaloo homeowners. I first want to thank this court for at least taking the time to hear the issues in this case, which I think are pretty far-reaching, have some potential ramifications in the land use law area, and hopefully we can put this matter into perspective. I will, if it pleases the court, ask for about 5 minutes of rebuttal time. In this case here, the background facts I think the court has had a chance to take a look at, but some of the essential facts were this: is the county had made this interpretation that charter schools under the law were exempt from compliance with Chapter 205, which was a little bit puzzling because the statutory section under which this exemption determination was made provided that charter schools did not have to apply with state laws except for laws relating to the health and safety of the public. And in conjunction with that, determined that Chapter 205 didn't implicate those health and safety laws. If we step back and take a look at what this case is about, the initial threshold question was not whether or not the county should enforce Chapter 205, but whether or not this exemption provision applied. That was a threshold question that the trial court was asked to look at in this case. The health and safety issue that was implicated was this. Under Chapter 205, if you're operating on ag lands and you don't have a special permit and you're using the property for non-agricultural uses, you must get a special permit under Section 205-6. When you go through that special permit process, the primary question is whether or not an unusual or reasonable use of the land is being made. In the context of whether or not that use of the land is unusual or reasonable, the Land Use Commission, as well as the Planning Commission, takes a look at several criteria. One is whether or not there are adverse effects upon surrounding properties. Number two, whether there are unreasonable burdens upon public agencies, such as matters involving water, sewer treatment, drainage, safety of roads, and those kinds of issues. And in this case here, the charter school that was involved, Waters of Life, had already begun operating when this matter arose. They had not received Department of Health permits. They had not received building permits. They had not received occupancy permits. And all those issues would have come into play vis-a-vis the special permit proceedings. If those special permit proceedings had occurred, the neighbors, in this case, who were the members of the association that I represent, would clearly, living in proximity and being neighbors and having these sewage and road issues, have had a right to intervene and participate in those proceedings. And those proceedings, because this property was 20 acres an acre and exceeded 15 acres under Chapter 205, you had not only the Planning Commission, but also the Land Use Commission involved in approving this particular permit. In addition to this question, because state funds were being used for these operations, because the charter school was receiving state and federal funds and had used those to purchase these lands, we're now also dealing with implications of Chapter 343 as a predicate to filing the special permit application. So that also implicated Chapter 343. So we had these various issues that were underpinning the threshold issue of the exemption. And so what did the county do? The county had this interpretation. We requested the county to reconsider. Chris Ewan, who was the planning director at the time, said, "Sorry, if you don't like it, you can go take this to court." In this instance, the county, recognizing that there were some serious issues at stake, filed the declaratory action, named the Waters of Life School as a defendant along with the association. So we then counterclaimed against the county, seeking both declaratory and injunctive relief, and cross-claimed against Waters of Life, seeking the same kind of relief. So the issue is whether or not the trial court at that point had jurisdiction over the matter. We can approach this from a very simple level, which is to say, under the Hawaii Rules of Civil Procedure, as a defendant, and as a matter of due process, and as a matter of obligation under the rules there, we had to file an answer, we had to defend, and we were required to file a counterclaim in a timely fashion, which we did. So where did the ICA go wrong, so to speak, in this case? The ICA said, under Chapter 205, 205-12, the counties have the obligation to enforce Chapter 205. And that may be fine from a basic predicate of an agency having the obligation to enforce violations of Chapter 205. But it begs the question of whether or not the courts have a right to interpret that agency's interpretation, the validity of the agency's interpretation of that statute. And that's what declaratory proceedings are about. That's the ultimate authority of the court, which is to determine the validity of an interpretation. Interpretations of law are always legal questions. Chapter 205.12 was adopted in 1976. 1978, we know that the Hawaii State Constitution was amended to add Article 11, Section 9. Thereafter, and Article 11, Section 9 is pretty clear. It says private parties have a right to seek enforcement of laws relating to environmental control, conservation of resources, and pollution. Thereafter, the Hawaii State Legislature adopted Section 607-25, which basically says that private citizens have a right to seek injunctive relief and collect attorney's fees against private parties who will violate land use laws, and that statute specifically references Chapter 205 and Chapter 343 and Chapter 342 dealing with Department of Health permits for wastewater treatment. So what, in a nutshell, do we take a look at Section 205-12 in a vacuum? Or do you take a look at how it's been, for lack of a better way of looking at it, impliedly amended by the constitutional provision and by Section 607-25.
Mr. Ye,
yes.
The state says that you needed to assert a jurisdictional basis for your cross-claim. Assuming that your cross-claim were filed as an independent action, then you would have to state jurisdiction, right? And in effect, your cross-claim would be was in the status of an independent action. So if Article 11, Section 9, is labeled environmental rights, what evidence in the record is there that this came under 343? Assuming that state funds have to be expended, there's a threshold amount. Is there any evidence in the record as to whether or not that threshold amount was met?
Well, state funds were used in the record. We took the deposition of a couple of the representatives of Water of Life. They had actually used the state funds and grants that they had received to acquire this 28-acre parcel for several hundred thousand dollars. That was just the beginning. They then began to go onto this school site, use it to hold classes, teachers' sessions, computer labs, store equipment, hold administrative offices there. And so those all implicated the use of these funds and the lands. So, and as far as an independent basis goes, if the court takes a look at the line of cases this court cited in the Sierra Club versus DOT, which is I call Super Ferry 1, that whole long line of cases dealing with environmental enforcement, they had many common threads. One was challenge to agency determinations. Number two, enforcement of 205 and enforcement of 343. The predicate basis for those lines of cases that the court cited as authority was 632-1. It was the basic declaratory proceeding provision. And so that, yes, that...
The lower court seemed to say that it wasn't so much maybe environmental issues, it was use issues, saying that, I guess in its decision on the attorney's fees, that it didn't really fit under the development statute, 607. So assuming that it was a use issue, I mean, one, do you agree with that? And second, if it's a use issue, then it wouldn't come under 340.
Disagree, Your Honor.
Okay. That's the what the lower court said with respect to the attorney's fees.
What the lower court was doing was, and I think when we take a look at 607-25 and the legislative history behind that, this court in Kahana cited that legislative history and said 607-25, as intended by the legislature, was to further the ability of citizens to file these private citizen suits to enforce these laws. Okay? So 607-25 codified this constitutional right and recognized that that right existed, but what it did is it added this remedy of saying, recognizing, number one, that public agencies sometimes have limited resources to pay for these kinds of enforcement actions, and number two, encouraging citizens who don't have funds to go bring these lawsuits, that we're going to add this remedy of attorney's fees. Now, the conditions that the legislature added to 607-25 basically said and tried to define the circumstances under which you would get attorney's fees, but it wasn't saying that you couldn't bring a lawsuit to deal with the use of land. Chapter 343, when it deals with the issues of environmental impacts, don't necessarily talk about development per se. It talks about the use of land.
Could your theory revolve around a procedural injury? Could that be the basis for your claim?
That's
the cross claim.
Definitely. That's a second leg of the injury because, as I indicated before, we had claimed that the county had deprived the association of procedural due process by making this exemption determination, because when it made that exemption determination, it vitiated the whole special permit procedure. And in that special permit procedure, the association as neighbors would clearly, under long-standing intervention and standing law, have been able to intervene and raise these issues.
If you went under procedural injury, then you would, we have case law, i.e. Super Ferry 2, you don't need to go under Article 11, Section 9, do you? If your theory is procedural injury.
That's correct. That's an independent basis.
And so if you go under procedural injury because of the failure to hold hearings under 205, then that would give the court jurisdiction to hear your claim.
Under the Super Ferry decision, correct. And in Super Ferry was very analogous because in the Super Ferry decision, the court was dealing with the threshold question of whether or not DOT was required to have an EA, and whether or not the exemption determination had been vitiated, or vitiated the procedural aspects. And the procedural aspects in Super Ferry involved, to a large degree, the public's participation to comment in that environmental assessment process.
Also, is there a distinction here between whether a party has standing and whether they have a private right of action? Wasn't it the ICA focusing on whether there was a private right of action under Chapter 205, concluded that there was not, and that was really, if you look closely at their holding, that was their holding. And in order to address that, is that not something, or is that holding, at least in your view, inconsistent with Article 11, Section 9?
Very much so, and I think In the ICA decision below, as well as in Pono, the court kind of confused, because the line of cases involving standing and justiciability, they take a lot of different tracks, and that's why I was trying to bring this common thread into this picture, which is the ICA was really, to me, confusing the issue of who had the authority to enforce, which we agree the counties do, but it was taking a look at certain cases out of context. And what cases did the ICA cite in Pono as well as in our case? First case was Lanai Company. In that case, before this court, the issue was raised as to the violation of certain LUC conditions. And the county of Maui was saying, well, we don't enforce LUC conditions. That was the issue before the court. And this court said for future guidance, because 205.12 says counties enforce 205, county of Maui, you have an affirmative obligation if there's a violation of this LUC condition. We don't argue with that. But that's not the exclusive circumstances under which the issue of interpretation of laws arises, as in this case. The court then...
Lanai indicated that if the enforcement action was within the power of the counties, that on the face of the statute would exclude anyone else from enforcing 205. So it's, I would think, a reasonable inference that there is no direct right of action by a private person to enforce 205. Because the statute says counties enforce it. But if the county does not enforce it, because Lanai said there's an affirmative duty, then wouldn't a procedural injury argument kick in?
Certainly. And?
Well, that's the whole basis for a procedural injury doctrine.
Agreed. And then if you really strip that holding to its bare essentials, what do we have here then? We have the ICA saying that the executive branch, a public agency which has at least the initial duty of enforcing a law, gets to interpret and decide not to enforce, and that private citizens don't have a right to challenge that interpretation. I think that's wrong, because that then violates the separation of powers, because it delegates the entire authority for interpretation of laws, which is this court's function, the trial court's function, to do.
Counsel, if 205.12 is interpreted to deny a private right of action to a citizen to enforce an environmental or a Chapter 205 claim, would that not be inconsistent with the plain language of Article 11, Section 9? And if so, would we be obligated to, under our typical doctrines of statutory interpretation, interpret it in a way so as not to reach that conclusion?
Absolutely correct. The doctrine of implied amendment is this, is, and this is in NRA Water Use Permit Applications 11352, when the terms of a subsequent act are so inconsistent with the provisions of the prior law that they cannot stand together. And so Article 11, Section 9 may not have expressly raised Chapter 205, but 607-25 certainly does. It names 343, 205, and a host of other statutes related to environmental protection, land use, and pollution.
Section 9 of Article 11 pertains specifically to environmental rights. Is that correct?
It's a little bit broader than that, and it states...
It's labeled or titled environmental, right?
Correct. It does.
It refers to environmental quality.
Environmental quality, control of pollution, and conservation, protection, and enhancement of natural resources. Now, when the court, if the court takes a, you don't have to go too far, but if you take a look at Chapter 205 dealing with district boundary amendments and issuance of special permits, all of those district boundary amendments provisions and review criteria as well as special permit deals with the issue of protection and conservation of resources. So the statute, it does go further.
Well, it says environmental quality, including control of pollution and conservation, etc. But if you read that very broadly to relate to land use, then isn't it difficult to draw a line as to what is environmental and issue and what is a land use issue?
Well, I will say that this Constitution reads rather broadly, because the Constitution actually reads rather broadly because it says inclusive of.
Yeah, but there are a lot of sections to Article 11. Some of them talk about conservation and water rights. So that would seem to indicate that Article 11 at least has a specific subject matter.
Taken on its own, one could come to that interpretation. I don't necessarily agree with it. But then one needs to then take a look at what the legislature did in 607-25, because it then, as part of the legislative history, was very clear that in implementing the right of private citizens under Article 11 to undertake these kinds of actions and to grant this additional remedy of getting fees in certain situations, it was also quite broad and inclusive, because it referenced, for purposes of this section, that permits or approvals required by law shall include compliance with permits or approvals established by Chapters 6E, 46, which is the county's authority to do zoning ordinances, 183, which deals with the Department of Land and Natural Resources' obligation to conserve resources, including conservation lands, 205 expressly. So the legislature at least thought that this provision was pretty broad.
Well, the legislature's opinion as to how far Article 11 goes,
yes,
or the scope of it, is not the final say on the interpretation of Article 11.
Not the final say, but it's certainly very helpful in guidance.
It's helpful in terms of what they tried to do in terms of 607.
Yes.
But their interpretation of Article 11 is not the final say on what Article 11 says.
This court seemed to adopt that in the Kahana decision by citing that legislative history.
In Kahana?
Kahana. Yes.
Well, I'm not sure it talked about environmental.
It did, and in fact, it cited the committee reports and legislative history in dealing with that issue. And when we get back to this implied amendment issue, when 607 specifically references 205, how do you square the two except by saying it was impliedly amended?
Well, I think you square the two by looking at Section A, which defines what a development is. So as long as you meet, I would think, just simply looking at the statute, the requirements in subsection A, and if that violates a permit requirement under any one of those sections, then you're in the statute. But not the other way around, that simply because you have a violation of a permit under any one of those sections, then you're in the statute.
You're within the coverage of the fees provisions.
Yeah.
Yes. So how do we really make sense of what the current state of the law is or should be? How do we read into Section 205-12 in conjunction with these other statutes? You know, sometimes we tend to look at things from a certain one-way glass. And I think the state of the law really is now that whether you're a landowner or a citizen that's challenging an agency interpretation of the land use law under 632-1, as well as the interpretations of this court, that basically if you have requisite standing, whether as a landowner that disagrees with the agency interpretation of the law, or a neighbor or citizen doesn't like that interpretation, and you have that requisite standing, you should be entitled to seek relief in the courts. And so long as all necessary parties are there, as was in this case, that should provide the court with sufficient jurisdiction. Thank you.
Counsel, do you have some time left, Counsel? If I could, in that time remaining, ask you to briefly address the issue of mootness, which was raised by the state, suggesting this dispute is moot and that the public interest exception to the mootness doctrine would not apply. Could you address those two issues?
Yes, Your Honor. This case, as the court calls, involves not only claims, first of all, as between the association and Waters of Life, but also involves claims against the county. The attorney's fees issue is still yet to be decided. If we determine that this case is moot, that this case needs to be dismissed, then that vitiates all the other remaining claims that are in this case. We still have claims against the county that we do want to proceed on under a private attorney general doctrine standard. Secondly, the issue of exemption of charter schools from compliance with land use laws is something that's going to rear its head time and again. And it's something that would be good to provide guidance to charter schools and the Department of Education when we're dealing with those issues. When I spoke to the planning director, current planning director, she said, well, this is good. I hope I'm here because I want to see what the court says about that issue. And then secondly, when we're dealing with issues such as this, when you're dealing with standing and public interest and the right of citizens to sue, this question is going to come up time and again also. So these are a matter of very important public interest that's going to repeat itself unless there's some real guidance from the court.
Is there any suggestion that there is still activity on the site? I know there was some, I thought you raised the issue as to whether the declaration had actually affirmatively closed off the possibility of there being some other activity continued on the site or a rental or some other future activity.
I'm not sure that there's any active things going on. There may still be things stored at the property, that kind of a thing, but active school operations I'm not aware of. But again, if this court were to dismiss this case, I'm not sure what might happen. They may try to enter into a lease. Who knows? But I think the public interest in questions are important.
Would the private attorney general doctrine fit for attorney's fees in this case?
I certainly believe so.
But you did not raise it.
We didn't raise it yet. The private attorney general doctrine hadn't really been very clearly settled by the time that we were at that stage.
Good morning. May it please the court. I am Charlene Aina, Deputy Attorney General, and I represent Wyola Public Charter School in this proceeding. We are here this morning for the limited purpose of arguing the merits of the Alaloop homeowners petition or application for writ of certiorari from the Intermediate Court of Appeals judgment on appeal and summary disposition order reversing the Third Circuit Court's judgment in the association's favor for lack of subject matter jurisdiction. The ICA did not reach the merits of the other points of error that Wyola raised, and it is our understanding that those points would be addressed only if this court concludes that the courts have subject matter jurisdiction to determine whether private individuals, including the association, the Alaloop Homeowners Association, has a right conferred by law to enforce the state's land use laws. Petitioner begins this morning by asserting as the final reason why this court must reverse the ICA, the fact that, or at least the allegation that, Wiola was using the property it owned at Alaloop Road for non-agricultural purposes. In the Third Circuit, that was the crux of the issue. But throughout the proceedings, Wiola would assert that it was an assertion in anticipation of what might happen at the property on Alaloop Road. And it's for those reasons that before the Third Circuit and in the Intermediate Court of Appeals, in its appeal, Wiola opened with the assertion that the court lacks subject matter jurisdiction both for jurisprudential reasons, standing, mootness, sovereign immunity, but also because the legislature had not, had in fact determined as a matter of public policy that the enforcement of the land use laws were to be undertaken by the counties. And that this court, both in Lanai Company versus the Land Use Commission and in the Pono case, confirmed that that was the case, that that is Wiola's position.
Is there a private right of action under Article 11, Section 9?
There is not. And that is for all of the reasons that have previously been discussed. Essentially, what's critical for either what's critical to the standing argument that comes from Super Ferry 1, from Article 11, Section 9, is for the lawsuit to be based on an environmental law, a law that was enacted to protect the environmental quality. As you yourself pointed out, Justice Akoba, in this case arises under, this appeal arises under Chapter 205. The controversy here is, did Wiola behave in any way in violation or in any way that violated the provisions of Chapter 205? Without the footing in an environmental quality law, and we acknowledge that there are references in Chapter 205 to environmental areas, environmental effects. Certainly, we recognize that when the Land Use Commission classifies lands, that its decisions must address certain aspects that relate to the environment. But those are not what drive Chapter 205.
Counsel, can I try, just so I'm clear, are you saying as a matter of law, Chapter 205 is not an environmental quality statute that would fall within the scope of the right that appears to be conferred by plain language in Article 11, Section 9?
Yes. Section 1 of Act 161, I believe it was, which was the first instance in which the state of Hawaii enacted the land use law, effectively says that it was enacted to assure the appropriate development of land in order to protect the economic interests of the state and its people. I'm paraphrasing the language, but effectively it was an economic development law. Its placement in the statutes are within that section of the Hawaii Revised Statutes that address economic development. What was of particular concern, and this is reflected in the subsequent amendment that was made to the law, was that agriculture be protected. Agriculture at the time was the state's principal industry, principal source of revenue, principal aspect of its economy, and the law was passed for that purpose. Since that time, the legislature has added, if you will, as I noted earlier, aspects that or considerations, topics, areas that relate to the environment, just as there are topics that relate to cultural and historical preservation, to social concerns.
Why wouldn't that be dispositive if they'd done so? Because isn't the whole point or one of the premises of Article 11, Section 9, that it's a right to enforce the law as it then exists, as the legislature has defined it? That was sort of the whole premise of the framers, that the right would be tracked, the substantive right would be determined by the legislature. So if the legislature, subsequent to the original enactment, added provisions in Chapter 205 that relate directly to, in 205.17.3, the preservation or maintenance of important natural systems or habitats, maintenance of valued cultural, historical, or natural resources, maintenance of other natural resources. So if the legislature subsequently added provisions in Chapter 205 that require the consideration of those types of issues in the permitting process, has not at that point or did not at that point Chapter 205 become an environmental quality law within the meaning of Article 11, Section 9?
You know, Justice Rechtenwald, I submit the term environmental quality is one which it's a term that, without diminishing its importance, is a catchword, certainly a catchword under Chapter 343, under the federal NEPA laws, under all of the environmental laws. But what for instance, 205.17 directs the Land Use Commission to, when it says, look at these things. It is simply a list of things that are to be considered in the overall context of balancing whether agricultural lands in particular and other lands, urban, rural, should be used for something other than the Land Use Commission has previously classified them for use for. These classifications can change.
Absolutely, but that was exactly the intent of the framers of Article 11, Section 9, is that as they change, the right or the substantive right that could be enforced would change. But the procedural right to enforce whatever those substantive rights were would remain.
To qualify for the procedural right, I believe one would have to say that the law in fact conferred that right. And here, the legislature, in balancing the economic considerations underlying or the principal economic objective underlying the land use law, the legislature is left with the prerogative of determining whether who or what should enforce the land use laws. If we take what petitioner is suggesting to its ultimate extension, 205.12 would be unconstitutional. And at this point, the fact that there are at least five references in Chapter 205 to aspects or areas or effects that are commonly thought of as being, as relating to environmental quality, in Wyola's mind, would not constitute a sufficient basis for this court to say Article 11, Section 9 controls.
It would be constitutional only if we interpreted it as impliedly foreclosing the right of private enforcement. And isn't it an equally reasonable interpretation that it was simply addressing the question as between various government agencies who might enforce what I believe are there actually criminal penalties, certainly administrative sanctions, there had to be a decision made or had to be some identification of which governmental agency would have the power and the obligation to conduct that enforcement. But the statute is frankly silent, certainly not explicit, on the issue of foreclosing private enforcement.
Well, I would suggest by analogy that the distinction between activities conducted by a private entity and activities conducted by a public entity, such as a public charter school, have been distinguished, for instance, in 607.25. There the legislature has said that in furtherance of the environmental action, when there is a controversy between two private entities, that attorney's fees can be recovered because it's necessary for a private entity not to have for the cost of litigation not to discourage a private entity from pursuing a claim against another private entity. But again, if the suggestion is that all 205-12 stands for is differentiating between which of the two regulatory participants, the LUC or the counties, ought to enforce the land use laws, we would suggest that the distinction is more than that. The distinction is in recognition of the fact that these are the kinds of things that need to be handled by the government, and it's for that reason that the legislature said in 205.12, and it's been a while since this court determined Lanai Company and the ICA decided Pono. And the legislature, I don't believe, has seen fit to or feel threatened in any way as to, or felt threatened in any way as to any constitutional uncertainty for 205.12.
But when the legislature enacted 607.25 in 1986, the committee report, I believe, said the bill will give fuller effect to Article 11, Section 9, which gives Hawaii's people the right to bring lawsuits enforcing environmental laws.
At the same time, however, it did not give private individuals access to attorney's fees when the state was doing development, and this court recognized that in its Super Ferry 2 decision.
Right, but the attorney's fees issue, as Mr. Yeh suggested, is somewhat distinct from the issue of whether there's a right to sue to enforce. And in fact, if you go back to the plain language of Article 11, Section 9, it says any person may enforce this right against any party, public or private. So the plain language of Article 11, Section 9 seems to envision that a private party could bring an enforcement action against a public entity.
At the same time, Your Honor, if I may, we went down this road on the question as to whether, in fact, 207-12 might be unconstitutional, given if you interpret Article 11, Section 9 as being so extensive as to make the environmental laws or any statute that makes reference to an environmental consideration superior or inferior to any other attempt by the legislature to prescribe how laws are to be enforced. I mean, it's a well-established proposition that, in contrary to petitioner's assertion, that individuals have the right to sue. I mean, there are as the standing precedent of this court recognizes, to the extent that procedural right is conferred, then certainly they do have. But in the instance when the procedural right is not conferred, then the ordinary test as to standing has to be assessed and satisfied. Here, the record does not establish any particular harm, any conduct different from any other conduct that occurs on Ala Loop Road. The petitioners anticipated that Waiola would put their school on their farm lot.
If Article, I guess, 11, Section 9 does not apply, simply because then it's very difficult to determine what's environmental. Everything, in a sense, is environmental. But what about the procedural injury doctrine that was established in Super Ferry that Mr. Ye referred to, assuming that these licenses are required and therefore the commission would have to hold a hearing, but by not holding a hearing, the commission then precludes the citizens from voicing their opposition. Would that fit to, in this case, the right, the idea of a procedural injury?
The procedural injury, well, petitioner would have been entitled to intervene in any planning commission proceeding that might have been initiated if what Wiola was doing violated the land use laws. The county initiated this action for the very purpose of determining whether the land use laws were being violated. There was a concrete difference of opinion among the association's members, the county council, the county planning commission, the county corporation council, and the attorney general as to whether charter schools were excluded from the land use laws. And petitioners could have brought a motion for summary judgment in that very case. And that procedural argument that they're, the procedural injury argument they're making here would have disappeared. They chose instead to pursue only as against Wiola, not against the cross-claim, the other cross-claim defending county. They chose to prosecute by default, by the entry of a default judgment, this particular case, which is now moot.
Here's my question was conceptually, assuming that they make the claim that they are precluded from appearing before the Land Use Commission in order to raise objections to a situation where a permit is required, would that fall under the doctrine of a procedural injury?
Only if the legislature's enactment of 205.12 is unconstitutional, because 205.12 essentially says the answer to their claim is no. There is no, they have no procedural right. No.
2512 says that counties have the duty to enforce
yes.
The LUC provisions. But Lanai said that the counties have an affirmative duty to enforce. But if the counties do not enforce, then would there be a procedural injury in the sense that because a commission does not convene a hearing, then the citizens don't have an opportunity to voice their objections to the failure to require a permit.
It comes back to the question Justice Rechtenwald asked, which is, did the legislature in enacting 205.12 essentially preempt the field and say, as to the enforcement of land use laws, as the ICA found in Pono, only the counties can enforce the land use law.
Except in Super Ferry, we found that where people have concrete injury, then by case law, they would have the right to a hearing, etc., so that they can claim procedural injury as a basis for standing.
But you're
So that would apply irrespective of Article 11, Section 9, or any other provision in the Constitution.
That holding would control, we submit, only if Article 9, Article 11, Section 9 did control, in that is, only if Chapter 205 was an environmental law. Our understanding of the Super Ferry decision is that the procedural right must be conferred by law. And when you're working in a environmental quality controversy, that implicitly or expressly it is conferred by Article 11, Section 9. But
are you saying that 205 doesn't provide for public hearings with respect to permits?
If a landowner petitions to reclassify the land, the 205 allows.
Yeah, or for a special or exceptional use for ag land.
205 allows for intervention, certainly, yes. It's the enforcement aspect that, all pivots on whether there's a private right of action or whether 205-12, the legislature is constitutionally permitted to pass 205-12 and in such a way as to limit private rights of action. I mean, procedural injury, the procedural injury doctrine clearly flows from Article 11, Section 9, because it confers a right which, under that doctrine, individuals have the ability to sue to protect.
If you have a procedural right, then why say you have a private right of action?
The distinction, the procedural right, if it needs to be expressed, in Super Ferry, it flowed from the express provisions of Article 11, Section 9. And the implied case, the case law that developed from it to say, if the Constitution gives you a right, then there's an inherent concomitant right to protect the right procedurally by suing. But if the Constitution or a law does not confer a right procedurally or substantively, then there would not be the right to sue unless the legislature conferred the private right of action.
So could the law be a provision in 205 requiring a public hearing or allowing intervention in a public hearing on whether an exceptional use permit can be granted in an ag district?
In that context, I would agree, or we would agree, that there is a right of participation, no question, a right of participation. But the question here is there a right to initiate the action? And the private right of action doctrine gives a person the right to initiate the action. All of Hawaii's standing doctrine, the standing precedent, flows, I think all of us understand, it flows from Town versus Land Use Commission, a land use case. But that was because the participation that was sought was in a proceeding that had been initiated by someone who had the right to ask for reclassification.
The private right of action.
In the form of the landowner who wishes to use his or her property for something, for a use other than presently permitted under the land use law. Or if the county...
Are you talking about a hearing under 205, or are you talking about Article 11, Section 9?
I'm talking about Chapter 205. That under Article 11, Section 9, what would be necessary is for the subject of the suit to be a law relating to environmental quality, not just one that refers, as Chapter 205 does in several places, to environmental considerations, but one that was enacted to further and to protect environmental quality itself.
How is it utilizing the property?
it is not utilizing the property in any way, and it does not anticipate using the property in any way in the future. It no longer owns the property. As of June 17, 2009, the property no longer belongs to Wiola. Wiola has never situated its school activities on the premises. And as its present director indicated in the declaration that was attached to the school's opposition to the petition, it has no intention of using that property for its school.
Mr. Ye indicated that he understood that the property was used for storage, equipment, computers.
That was certainly an assertion included in the record below at the time that Wiola owned it. But as according to the declaration and my conversations with the director, Wiola has left the premises, if you will.
So what the court's finding was that it was being utilized at the time?
At the time, certainly in 2004 and 2005, when the court entered its judgment, the Third Circuit entered its judgment, books, equipment, and files were stored in the warehouse at Wiola. At the Alaloop property, just like books, computer equipment, other unused equipment were stored in the garages of the other farmers on Alaloop Road.
So I understand, though, what you're saying is that Wiola does not own the property at this present time. Is that correct?
Yes.
And that is included in the declaration.
Excuse me, sir.
The declaration, what is evidence of Wiola not owning the property?
The petition, or the Wiola's opposition to the petition includes a copy of the warranty deed that was registered at the Bureau of Conveyance after the property was conveyed to Sunshine Farms, I believe.
Counsel, what about the public interest exception to the mootness doctrine? Wouldn't you agree this is a matter of not just a private dispute, but a public dispute, which is likely to come up again, and that would benefit public officials to know whether they have the obligation to enforce the law solely, or whether there's also a private enforcement obligation or opportunity?
The critical aspect of capable of repetition and evading review with its public interests exception on the exception depends on whether it's, in Wiola's view, depends on whether the situation is likely to recur again. Land use proceedings, how somebody is using land, is almost always fact specific. You have to know what land you're talking about. You have to know what activity is occurring before you can determine that the land use law or whatever conditions are applicable to that particular parcel have been violated. This is not the kind of case in which an agency has a rule that appears a little suspect and perhaps could use the guidance of a court in determining how that rule should or should not be applied. In every instance, you would have to assess what was happening on the site and who was doing it. There's no such thing as a perpetual injunction.
That's not what the ICA did here. The ICA here said no private right of action to enforce 205, period, as a matter of law. That's a question, wouldn't you agree, which could and will come up in the future when other disputes arise where individuals seek to enforce 205 through private enforcement means, and for county and state officials when they're trying to decide how to use their resources, whether they can count on or not count on the possibility of private enforcement.
Well, but that puts the horse before the cart. I mean, mootness doctrine is about the facts that the court must have in order to avoid rendering an advisory opinion. We could sit, each of us, and say, okay, this is what this law means. But that's not what courts exist to do. Courts exist so that they have the benefit of specific facts to determine whether a law is or isn't violated, is or isn't being applied properly. It's not what the court said about the law that needs to be assessed for purposes of whether a case is moot or not. What needs to be assessed for purposes of whether a case is moot or not, or even whether the community would benefit from the court's rendering an opinion, is whether there's a real controversy existing, a context, a real non-speculative, non-hypothetical context in which to apply the proposition of law that the court wants to speak about. So we're not in any loss for purposes of deciding what the law says or doesn't say. But before we can address what the law says or doesn't say, there has to be concrete reason for this, in fact. And in this case, Wyola no longer is on the premises. Wyola no longer owns the premises. Wyola says it has no intention to return to the premises. And under those circumstances, there's no need for this court to determine, or any court to determine, whether Wyola or any other charter school is violating the land use laws at the Ala Loop location. Thank you.
How much time does Mr. Yeh have? You have 2 minutes, sir.
Case really has very illustrative of why the position that we're advocating should be adopted by the court. When we filed our motion seeking relief in the court, the county basically provided a position that we take no position on this issue. In the issue of public interest and mootness, I mean, I have a case now where the neighbors have said, county do something. We try to get the county to do something. I've told them, we've got to deal with this case first, because if we don't, we're going to get shot down based on this decision that the ICA has made. So this question will come up on a repeated basis. The trial court made specific findings and conclusions of law that the school was holding classes, computer labs, teaching students, had administrative offices. This is not just a matter of storing equipment. I really find it strange also that the Attorney General's office is saying that, you know, Chapter 205 doesn't implicate environmental laws. When dealing with district boundary amendments, as an example, the Land Use Commission is supposed to deal with the impact of the proposed reclassification, preservation and maintenance of important natural systems or habitats, maintenance of valued culture, historic, or natural resources. When the Land Use Commission takes a look at special permits, the Attorney General's Office, October 22, 2003, this is our Exhibit A to our Exhibit C on our petition for cert, wrote a letter to Lincoln Ishida, the Corporation Counsel, saying when reviewing special permits, the commission is supposed to take a look at whether or not the use is contrary to the objectives sought to be accomplished by the land use law. So to say that the special permit process doesn't implicate these same conservation of resource issues is really not credible. That's all I have, and I really thank you for this opportunity.
The court thanks counsel for taking this matter under advisement.